Hello, Billy Patterson here. Nearly 30 years ago on my Castaway programs, I talked with local people about their lives. Stay tuned and listen again to the following fascinating story.
Hello and welcome again to another Castaway. The program where we take the well-known person from the northwest of Ireland, we deposit them on a desert island, find out what 6 pieces of music they would like to take with them, what 2 books apart from the Bible, and we will give them 1 luxury. Now, my guest this week is a poet, a traditional singer, a folklorist, a writer, and many other things besides. He's Patrick Pearse Tunney, known to us all up here as Paddy Tunney. Paddy, you're very welcome to Castaway.
Thank you very much, Billy.
Right. First question, Paddy. When were you born and where were you born?
I was born on the 28th of January, 1921, in Springburn, Glasgow, Scotland. But I was only there for a fortnight and they took me home then. Both my parents were Irish, of course. One was from Donegal and the other from Fermanagh. But there was only a little brook separating the two town lands. On the northwest frontier, between Ballintra and Pettico, that area. Up in the area known as Mountain Streams Country, which is one of the songs that my mother sang. I sing it too.
Is that right?
So
you don't consider yourself to be a Scotchman at all?
Oh, not at all. No way.
I always understood.
It's 7 generations, you know, to make you, to change you from one nationality to another.
Does it take 7?
Same as a paper. It takes 7 generations to make a good paper.
So the first man out has no chance.
Yeah. None at all.
All right.
None whatsoever.
I always thought you were a Fermanagh man.
Well, I lived most of my life. I was brought up in Fermanagh. And I was about 2 or 3 years in Russian, Pettigo, County Donegal, and then we moved down to Mulick, Castle Colwell in County Fermanagh. And my brother is still there in the old family homestead up in the townland of Garvey, which looks out over Lower Lochearn and the woods of Rushmore and that territory, and Fiddlestone Country, where the famous stone fiddle was struck for the fiddle player, Dennis McCabe, who was musician and jester to Sir James Colwell, Baronet and Count of Milan.
My goodness gracious.
Who fell out of St. Patrick's barge on ye 13th of January, 1770. And they were all so drunk on the barge that they couldn't haul him in again, and it said that when he came up the third time, he was still sawing away.
Well, listen, can we come back to it? The stone fiddle is going to come into our story later on. What I want to do is keep you back in the early days, Paddy, just in the meantime, because we want to find out about, we know sort of a lot of us know the Paddy Tunney.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to do is find out what made Paddy Tunney the way he is. What was your father doing in Scotland?
Well, my father worked in Lochearn Steelworks, which we would call a foundry in this country. And during the war, the money was good there, the work was hard. But then, when he being a married man, he wasn't conscripted. But it was called kind of sheltered work at that time. It was part of the war effort because they were providing the steel for making the battleships.
You're talking First World War here, 1418.
First World War, yeah. And anyway, then, when post-war period set in, things got very bad, and depression set in, insofar as work went anyway. So he came to the conclusion that it'd be better to come home. And he came home and lived for about 2 years with my maternal grandfather, Michael Gallagher, the man who taught me my first verse of Thalac in the Morning when I was 4.
That's right.
And then we moved to Garvey in County Fermanagh. And it was there that I was brought up and spent all my time until I went to the university, UCD, and qualified as a health inspector and started with the public health services and the county councils first, you know.
Right, well, that's further down the line. Who was your mother, Paddy?
She was Bridget Gallagher, and she was a great singer. I got most of my big songs of her. And her Aunt Mary was known as Mary of the Mountain Streams. She was a great singer too, and she was married to a Mick Fady Gallagher, so that their children had the cure of the mumps. the two similar surnames. But he was from Cashelard, and he hadn't a note. He wouldn't know the difference between the soldier's song and the sash.
And, serious problem in Ireland.
But he was a great storyteller. And it was he told a great story about the water hush that came out and tried to serve a wee mare of his. And when they got the mare the next day, they thought it was dead from the exertions, but actually it had only fainted, and they skinned it, and when they had the skin off, the mare jumped up and away round the field without a skin. So that great trouble lassoing it and tying it up, and they scalloped the skin on again. But he never could put a harness on it after. But it used to grow a crop of rods every year, black sally rods, and he used to cut them for scallops and sell them in the fair of Ballyshanny. That was Mick Gallagher. And the one said, well, he wouldn't have been any relative of mine, but his wife would have been, I suppose, a great-great-grand-aunt or something like that. But she had a lot of these songs. She had Mountain Streams, Sheelin' Ye Eyre, Easter Snow, Highland Mary, The Cool Winding Air, and a stack of others, Craigie Hill, The Banks of Dunmore. She was a great singer, apparently, and she had a sister, Sarah, that was a great singer. But I would say the singing came to me from the Gallagher side of the household, even though my father was a very good step dancer in the traditional way. Mm-hmm. And my aunt, Biddy Tunney, was a great melodeon player. Now, not an accordion, but a melodeon with the 10 keys and the 3 stops that you put down, you know.
I'll talk to you about that in a minute.
Yeah.
But could I ask you, first of all, Paddy, you know these 6 pieces of music now.
Yes.
What would your first choice of music be now?
Well, my first choice would be Huey Gillespie, that great Carrick McGrath Ballybuffet fiddle player, who was taught by Coleman, playing Master Crowley's Reels.
That was a little bit of Huey Gillespie playing Master Crowley's Reels. What was the difference again, Paddy, you were telling me just before we start, between a melodeon and accordion?
Well, the melodeon was a simpler instrument, and it had only one row of keys. Most accordions have 2 rows, and some of them 3, some of them 5, and one often wonders what they're all for. But the melodeon, one got a nice, crisp, sharp note off it, and the simpler tunes were very easy played, particularly dance tunes. My Aunt Biddy now played it mostly for dancing, for the single reel, which was a great go in the country, in the kitchens at that time, dancing on the flag floors, and for the quadrilles and the lancers and highlands, big wild highlands that they used to dance. Barn dances and long Germans and mazorkies and shoot the donkeys, but the polite people would never call it Chewed the Donkey. They called it the Verse of Vienna, you see.
Called it what?
The Verse of Vienna.
Verse of Vienna?
Verse of Vienna, if you don't mind, you see.
Oh, excuse us.
It was too like the bog dove, the ass and it, the donkey, you see, chewing the donkey. So, of course, a donkey is quite a respectable animal. After all, it was on a donkey that Christ rode, so I don't see why people thought that there were being very, very low if they only could raise to an ass instead of a horse, you know.
No reason at all, Paddy. No. Well, listen, did you have brothers and sisters, Paddy?
There was 8 of us all together, and I was the 3rd. Maureen, Brady, myself, Phyllis,
and Annie and Joe in Tina or Teresa and Michael. Now there's two of them dead. Annie lost her life in a fire in her own house, 1976, Mrs. Lunny. And she'll be on this twins cassette that's coming out of three generations of Tony singers.
Yeah, I'll talk to you about that one later. Yeah.
Joe was a great accordion player and had the Cuchulainn Ceilidh band for nearly 20 years. And he died of cancer in 76, I think it was, or 75. No, 79. And he was a very good step dancer. So was Michael, the youngest brother, who's living at home and works in the flowering shop in Billy Pottery. Maureen was a good singer. Beattie was the name they called her at home, kind of a pet name, but she always wanted to be called Brady. She was a very good step dancer, but she was small and very late on her foot, and she used to do the 26 steps of Maggie Pickens, the old Donegal set dance.
What was particular about that one?
Well, it was the timing. The time is different. It's somewhere in between a reel and a jig. Like it goes, Douglas McGinley, the kilted barrister, used to dance it here in Letterkenny, but he didn't dance the 26 steps. He only had about 14, you know. But it wasn't bad. And each step had to be
perfect
and executed in certain ways, you know.
Where do these very unusual time signatures in music come in, Paddy? I mean, is that...
Well, you see, a lot of people hold that Maggie Pickens came from a sword dance, but I don't know how possibly you could get in the trebles and things and not cut the feet of yourself if you were dancing over two swords.
Aye,
you know.
Yeah.
But I would say it probably came across from Scotland. The tune sounds Scotch. Mm. The time sounds kind of Scotch, you know. Mm. But there was great commerce between Ulster, particularly counties Antrim and Down and part of Derry, and the Hebrides and the other islands of Scotland there. And there was an interchange in their songs and in their music always, of course.
Mm.
And anyway, then there was Phyllis, was a good step dancer. And actually, I was supposed to be the worst dancer of them all. And they used to laugh so much at me that I stopped trying to do step dancing, you know. But I used to do ceilidh dancing, and I could do sets and Highlands and the Lancers and things like that.
I've seen you dance, Paddy. No, there's nothing wrong with your dance.
But if you saw the others, like you
make
would know the difference.
Like a cardboard,
Actually, we danced last Thursday at that launching. Myself and Phyllis did four or five steps of a reel and turned and pivoted and all that.
Okay, well, that's all in the future. I'm trying to keep you back in the past here. Right. Where did you go to school, Paddy?
I went to school in Durrahalla Public Elementary School. And
that was in
County Fermanagh.
It is in Fermanagh,
just over
the border, right?
It was in County Fermanagh. And I very well recollect a Mr. Doakes, a senior school inspector, arriving when I'd be about 10 or 11. And he took all the classes, and then he took a singing class. And of course, the teacher used to learn us these wee innocent inanities like, "Oh, the boating lightly floating merrily away," or "Merry, merry gypsies are we." But he stood back and he said, "Is there anyone here could sing a song that they learned at home?" And I was a lot shyer then than I am now, but anyway, I plucked up courage and I sang Bowl of Vogue. And the teacher nearly collapsed, of course, because she thought she'd be sacked, that he might think that she taught me this song. And Mr. Doakes came over and gave me a half a crown, and it was like £1,000 comparison. At that time, he said, "We should be teaching history in the schools." I remember that clearly, you know.
Very good. So you started singing for profit very early.
Well,
in
that
your life,
was the first money that I got for it anyway, and a half crown was
big money.
Lord, you'd sit up with it at night if you had a crown at him. You wouldn't go to bed at all.
Let me ask you about your second piece of music at this stage.
Yes. Well, what I would like is this Blas Mala, or a Sip from the Honey Pot. It's the selection of Gaelic songs, and what I want is Marian de Barra, sung by Eileen Newcorthan from Tournefola in County Limerick, who sings a beautiful version of this.
All right, better hear it.
Avairin de Barra.
Learn Irish at home, Paddy, or did you learn it at school?
Well, I learned it when I went to... We learned very little Irish at the school in Dhurahalla, but then when I went to the vocational school in Ballyshannon, it was Arana Fastman was the Irish teacher, and it was he that actually got me interested in a big way in Irish, and he actually offered to teach me Irish privately.
Why was that now?
Private tuition. At a shilling a lesson, and of course that was fierce money.
Oh, I see.
I couldn't take that up, but Condy O'Donnell was his name, and he used to sing Shan Luna Gael, and we had a wee problem raising the elbow too. And on Mondays, he was the devil on Mondays altogether. He was roaring and bawling all over the place, and he drank nearly a bucket of water. He was the thirsty, but he was a good Irish teacher. And I think he became the principal in Lochinvar Vocational School after that, you know. I only met him once after that.
But he just had a great love for the Irish language.
He told me that it would be easy for me to learn Irish. But a strange thing, Billy, in our part of the country, in West Fermanagh, a lot of their English is direct translations. For instance, they'd ask you, what's on you?
Oh, yeah.
And they'd say, what's he talking about? So there's no one putting to him or from him, which is a straight literal translation,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it was easy enough to get onto it that way.
You have a sadness on you.
Once one got the tongue round the slender ends in L's, which is hard enough, it was easy going after. And then I took a great interest in it after. And I used to, when I left the tech, I went to Gaelic League classes in Ballyshannon too, that Maury Gillespie used to teach that, the wee one that's alive down there in Gador still, you know. And when you get a certain distance, it's up to yourself. If you take an interest in the literature, you write. And I even tried to write in it, you know, and I had articles accepted by Antulta, and I had ones in the Irish press at the time that had a Gaelic column every day, you know. And at the time, Sorahin Yugurum was the Gaelic editoress there, you know. She was a great traditional singer too. And it helped me when I started to write my books. It gives you a kind of a very imaginative approach to things, to have the Irish to fall back on, you know. And the thing that they call Duhis, I would say that it was still there, because my grandfather, Michael Gallagher, who came from, his parents came from Finadoos outside Donegal town. It was Gaelic speaking at that time.
Mm.
And he had a lot of Irish. Even though his family, very few of them had it, you know. But they had all the yarns, and they could talk about different things, including the cat brack, which we won't discuss here. They didn't know actually what they meant, you know. There were no dictionaries around, of course. And he talked about them, and of course he was conversant with that and these other terms, you know. But they were talking about them, and they didn't actually know the meaning of them.
What's cat brack, Penny?
It's a spotted cat. It was the ones that taught Irish for the supers, you know, the proselytizers that came in. And went into mostly now in Achill. The name of the man escapes me now, but the Bible brought out in Irish, lovely Irish too, and it was just post famine time. So if they learned the Irish, the authorised version, they give them a Gaelic Bible and they give them the soup. And they turned the religion. And the old cynical saying was, the soul or souls for hairy, for penny rolls and soup and hairy bacon, you know. But that's what the cat bracks were. They were the ones who kind of acted as quislings to go in and spread the teaching of the Bible, the authorised version of it, in areas like Achill and elsewhere, you know. The positive side was that they kept the Irish alive.
No, they did indeed.
Yeah. I've seen one of the, was it Nagel they called him, I think? One of his Bibles, Manus O'Donnell of Achill, had it. Was beautiful print in it, you know.
What, these
the old
were
Gaelic
Irish,
found, you know.
These were Irish Protestants.
Yes, well, there were Irish Protestants going out preaching.
To convert the Catholics.
To convert the Catholics.
You become abroad, we'll give you a Bible in Irish and a loaf of bread.
And a bowl of salt.
Mm,
a soup and the hairy bacon too, of course. But that was what the cat brack was, you see. That was the name they put on it. They were spotted. The ornery cat would be all right, but the spotted one was to be regarded with suspicion.
Suspicion, I get it, right. Did your teacher in your national school influence you much, Paddy?
Yes, and so far as an appreciation of literature, which meant literature in the English language, and also...
Was that Mrs. McGrath?
That was Mrs. McGrath.
Yeah.
That's right.
You dedicated one of your books to
I did, Mary McElhinney. She was a great teacher, and she came to us when she was very young. And of course, I was about 12 at the time, and I fell head and heels in love with her.
Is that right?
She didn't know that until long after, until I told her, you know.
And you were only 12?
I was only 12, but of course, it was very platonic. There was another fella too, equally fell, and we used to lie behind the ditch to get carrying our bag, you see, and one would slip out, but if the other was a bit earlier, they had the bag to carry. That was the great thrill, carrying her bag.
She was a lovely young girl.
She was a lovely, very fine young girl. I mean, you see, she came to us when she was only about 22 or so, you know. And then
that's the stuff that 12-year-old dreams are made.
Well, that's what it is, of course. Yeah, very.
Dufus is the one that you.
Dufus
is the one that you.
No, I think it's the story, the collection of short stories that they dedicated to her, I think.
Well, I have it here in front of me. It's Mary F. McGrath, my first teacher, who encouraged me to write from an early age.
Oh, she did, yeah.
She did. So she was a big influence in your life.
And she encouraged me to go to the tech because on a small bit of a Drumlin farm in Fermanagh, I couldn't have been sent to the St. Michael's in Enniskillen because
too much. My
parents couldn't have afforded it.
Yeah.
So it was very difficult to get education, and of course... The tech at that time was a very small place, but we had a great teacher of English, Hilda O'Boyle, and she used to give me all kinds of books, Wuthering Heights and Tolstoy and all this at that time.
And you read them all?
Well, I used to read them, and even after I left and went to to work as a lumberjack in Castle Colwell. I used to visit her and she used to lend me these books.
Did you enjoy those books, Paddy?
Oh, very much.
Did you really? Yeah. I mean, you're only, what, 14 or 15, 16 years old?
When I went to work, I'd be 18. I was 18 and a half, I think.
Ah, but I mean, these books she was loaning you from you were young.
Well, when I was... I'd be at the tech firm, I was about 15 to 17 about that time. You know, it was 2 years at it. But certainly, I liked it very much and I used to write fairly good essays too.
You could read Tolstoy and understand.
The only thing that shocked me about Resurrection was this brothel
You wouldn't have known about a brothel.
I didn't know what it was, but I went to the dictionary and what prostitutes were and all this, and of course Tolstoy.
You thought they were failed Protestants?
No. I could tell you a story about that, but I won't. It wouldn't be fair, it would be nasty. But anyway, the thing was that I felt guilty about it, you see, but of course, myself, I didn't seem to think there was anything wrong, but it was a mission anyway, and I confessed that I had read this book. And you know what the missioner asked me? Was it about communism? I said, no, well, it was all right, he said.
Really?
So he probably was right, too.
That's all that counted.
Yeah, all counted at that time anyway, you know. But
you got a great love of books from Mr. Boyle
from
and
that,
Mr. McGrath.
Yeah. And so when I was working as a lumberjack...
After you left school, now.
After I left school.
Before you went to university?
Oh, yes.
Right.
And I worked for nearly 3 years, 2 years and a half there. And it was real slave labour, you know.
Chainsaws?
Well, there's no chainsaws that time. It was crosscuts and axe. Yeah. But you had to lug out timber and it skinned your shoulder. And the shoulders used to bleed and everything. We used to have to put methylated spirits on them to harden them up. It was very hard work.
You were cutting trees down in the woods
and felling them, making them into pit props for the coal mines because the Jerry had invaded Norway and they couldn't get the Norway pit props for the coal mines in England. So we had to cut down all the domains of forestry that was in that area at the time. Mm-hmm. And they were cut into 17 different sizes, 17 softwoods, 17 hardwoods. And my job used to be stacking at the mill and keeping 34 stacks going with two men sawing as hard as they could. And I never lost as much sweat in my life.
Mm.
I remember the first day that I went to work when we had sawed a pile of timber. I lay down on the sawdust. I left the print of my body behind in sweat. But I stuck it out and I started at 18 shillings a week. And after 6 months, I got a raise of a shilling and I had to sign six times for it.
Good.
And I had to go up on a Sunday to sign two and break the Sabbath. And it was pretty heavy work, but I suppose it's good for young fellas.
You're perfect the age for it.
Didn't do me a bit harm. No. It hardened me up a bit.
Yeah.
Those resin, your clothes was all stuck with resin.
From the pines.
And the forearms here, the resin used to stick in the hairs and used to cut them sometimes, but you get used to it. You got very hard. In fact, I think pain died in me at an early age because of that.
Give us record number three, Paddy.
Number three is The Wheels of the World, Michael Coleman playing a medley of reels. The Tar Bolton and Longford Collector.
You were lumberjacking. And then you went off to the university.
Did, yeah.
At where? Which university?
UCD.
UCD. And to do what, Paddy?
A health inspector's course, which was a crasher course that time. It was only 2 years, but it was long enough because when the 2 years were up, I nearly had exhausted all my savings, you know.
Right.
And finally then I got a job in Dublin Corporation. While I was a lumberjack, I wrote the poem, The Battle of Rossgoal, and got a half guinea prize in a competition in the Weekly Independent, the Irish Weekly Independent, which is no longer printed.
Mm.
I thought, you know, that the next thing would be the Nobel Prize, but or so far they haven't given me that anymore.
Stick around.
So when I went to the university, I met Tony Cronin there, Anthony Cronin, and he was running a university magazine, but he was frightfully leftist and socialist, and I didn't think that I would be capable of writing anything that would please him.
Mm.
And he asked me a few times. I was introduced to him by Paddy Carmody, who thought he was communist, but he only thought it, you know, one of these kind of intellectual communist theory only.
Yeah.
But while I was there, I had two poems accepted by Father Sennin in the Capuchin Annual, and that was actually the first decent money he gave me. 8 guineas each for them. I think he knew I needed it at the time, you know, and that kind of launched me. And then Ben Kiley, I met Ben, was literary editor of the Irish Press at the time. He had moved as leader writer with the Independent into Burke, and Ben took a lot of poetry from me, and I used to get 3 guineas a time, which wasn't bad at the time.
Did you do all your writing in English, Paddy? You did?
I did. I had a few articles published in the Irish Press at the time, and the Scaly Éireann part of it, on mostly about kind of traditional subjects in Irish. But my great ambition was to write in Irish, but I realised then that not being from the Gaeltacht, that the effort would be too great.
7 generations elapsed.
I'd have to strain too hard to write in Irish, even though I enjoy reading Irish very much, particularly the Donegal writers here. Sean Van McMenamin and Shosa and Seamus Aguirreina, and well, others like Seamus O'Sharkey, and a great poet today, you know, Cathal O'Sharkey too, that's in Gortahorc there, and a great friend of mine, a short story writer from Killarney, Seamus Ta Fhuinneach, he's dead now, the Lord have mercy on him. He was associate editor. And I remember going along when I was at the university with these poems and showing them to him. And he said, it was good stuff, but it wasn't Bell stuff. I'd advise you to go to Father Sennin with it. So he did take them. And then the crowning glory was when I had a poem accepted for the literary page of the Irish Times. Bruce Williamson was the literary editor at the time. I think it was Sapspill or something like that, I called it. I got 4 or 5 guineas for it. But off and on, I contributed a good bit to him after, you know, say every 3 or 4 months. And he always published them, and I was always paid in time. Never had to write in for it. But
take you on a different tack again, because we're into the writing and the poems. Where and when did you meet your wife? Now, her name is Sheila.
Yeah, Sheila Bradley from out there, the legend.
You came to Letterkenny to work, by the way.
I came to Letterkenny to work in the public health section of Donegal County Council, and she came as a public health nurse, I think about a year or two after I came. That's how I met her. Met her in the office. And
love at first sight, Paddy.
Well,
or did you get used to one another, get to know one another?
There was a kind of an attraction there from the beginning. Paddy Lavin, who was the town clerk here at the time, the offices that we had were nothing like the offices the health people have then. It was the old technical school down there. There was only one toilet, and it was upstairs, up in the attic, and there was no washhand basin, but in an antechamber outside the nurse's office, there was a washhand basin, you see, but you needed a key to get in. And Lavin remarked that I was washing my hands oftener than he thought I should.
And he said this in no uncertain terms, a language that you couldn't use over the air, you know. Yes, so and so, you're washing your hands too much. You know, he was a common man.
Uh-huh.
But it was he that kind of detected there was something afoot. Mm-hmm. So that's how I met her. I got married in 55, and we went to live first in the station house out in Drumcairn, and then in Billy Patterson's Green Cottage, Labadish. It was a great place to start a family.
That's not me now who's talking about.
It's Billy, the man with all the land. Killian
right.
is the man that's there now. Mm. But he was a very decent man. I tell you, he only charged me £1 a week for that place. And we were only in it about 3 weeks when he came up to her. He says, "Mistress, you're about to get luck of hens, for there's a lot of grain going to loss here." And there was a wee shed that she only had about 10 hens and a rooster with them. And she used to come out and feed them, but there was an old farmer way on down Bimaherbeg, and he used to come to get corn crushed. And this rooster that we had was half game. The rooster used to light on his shoulder and start pecking at his old hat, you see. And she'd come out, "Birdie, birdie, birdie," and he'd say, "Oh, it's all right, birdie, birdie, and your hens to the elder and ma corn." But there were very pleasant times there. There was a big barn in the front, and I coped it and put in potatoes and everything, and I had a great time out there. And then when the children became school age, I thought,
how many children have you had?
Just six.
Ach, very few.
Small.
You
small
didn't play
family.
Your part at all.
Not at all. I would elect 15 in a sub, you know. I think maybe we weren't, we didn't get married soon enough. But not bad. There was one every year. And I tell you, there was a character out there. Oh, a rich character, Bob O'Donnell. And he had a cure for evil in these things. And
a cure for what?
Evil, you know, a running sore. Evil, the old people used to call it. Doctors could do nothing for this. And Bob was the seventh son of a seventh son. And he used to, he laid his hands and cured them. But they used to be lined up. They came from all over to him, from other counties as well as Donegal. It was only the first hour of Sunday morning that he could cure. And some people.
Do you mean like 1 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, of a Sunday morning.
Right, surely.
You know, they'd be there lined up on Saturday night. They said this cure came down from the apostles. I don't know, but he could cure anyway. He'd never take money. Like, he'd take kind, but not cash. But he came down to the yard once, and he'd heard there was another baby in Tunney's, and he saw Sheila, and she was expecting again. And he says, "Oh, not again, Mrs., not again. Why don't you take him up to the top of Mongori and tether him? They're tethering other arms these days."
Well, we should tether you here now, because we're at the top of Mongori at the moment. We better go into your fourth piece of music here.
Yeah. This is Una One of a record, Jora Alia, which means the drops of a cliff. It's the name of the town land, and this lady is part of Connemara. She was Maya Anya Nigonaha. She only died about 6 months ago. And this song, Una One, is one of the few of the Cainiu or the lament songs that's left in English or Irish. There's one left in English, Ballanderry.
Oh, yes, yes.
It's pretty to be in Ballanderry. And it was collected and written down by Bunting exactly 200 years ago. And at that big harp festival in Belfast in 1792. Now, this is the same kind of a song, and it's... You would describe her as a classical Sean Nosso traditional singer. Like, she doesn't use the foghorn effects that other Connemara singers. If you like, she's a more civilized singer.
Refined.
Than them. Yeah.
So it's Una Vaughan or Fair Una.
Fair Una.
Fierska porka
a little bit of Fairuna there, Paddy. Yeah. That's a keening song, the song that was sung at a funeral.
In fact, it's probably the oldest tradition extant that we have, because that goes back to the time of Christ. If you remember when he came along to raise the widow's son, or some of the people that he raised from the dead according to the gospel, he had to silence the professional keeners that was there, and they mocked him because they said this person was dead. Well, keening in the Irish language, whether it derived from that tradition or not, it survived until quite recently on the islands. I heard it myself in 1952 in Arranmore there, an old lady keening a dead person. And I know that still on the Aran Islands off Galway, they do it. Because I remember being out there doing a housing survey, and a man died, and my missus was doing relieving public health, a nurse at the time, and they came and they keened him. And they lifted him up then before they put him in the coffin, and they touched the four posts at the bed with him before they put him in. And then she had to coffin him. None of the relatives would touch him. It had to be a stranger. They took him away in a tractor then to bury him, you know. And a tractor and a trailer, of course. But it's the same kind of keen you or keening. They have it in Torrey, but whether they do it still or not,
I was going to tell you that I saw there was a keener, because the song was called Una Vaughan. I knew a keener on Torrey Island called Una.
Yes.
And she was the priest's housekeeper.
Yes, yes.
And I saw her keening there in the graveyard, all right. And she was crying and moaning and shrieking at the graveside and making much hurrah
with her hands.
And as the priest walked away, she stopped in the middle of the keening. He said, "Father, your dinner's in the oven," and she went on keening.
It was a kind of a professional lamenting thing, you know. And it's Kitty Gallagher Gador used to sing a song or two of it, but it was very hard to get her to do it. You see, they thought that it was for this should be preserved for the dead and for wakes and things like that, and should not be sung as part of a huli or a session or anything like that, you know.
Right. Now you're in Donegal, and you're married, and you have six kids, and you were going to be tethered like a ram at the top of Mungari.
out in Labrador.
And all the time, Paddy, you're writing poetry.
Yeah.
You're singing
songs.
You're adjudicating musical festivals.
Yeah.
And finally, along comes Diane Hamilton, Boston millionaireess, very interested in traditional singing, and she decides she's going to make an LP.
Mm-hmm.
And she and Peggy Seeger collected the stuff for my first record, Paddy Tony Manus Songs, which was produced by Sandy Payton of Folk Legacy over in Vermont.
Now, this is Ewan McCall and Peggy Seeger. That Peggy Seeger.
That Peggy Seeger.
That Peggy Seeger. The famous
that was married to,
folk singer.
To,
yeah.
She was a half sister, Pete Seeger.
Pete Seeger, little boxes.
Anyway, that actually, the material for that was recorded on a ferrograph out in Green Cottage, Labadish, on a Saturday evening, with the mic away on the stairs, and Diane with the headphones, and Peggy there to adjust the mic in such a way that she said that the singing would have presence. And I think that Paddy Tony Manus Songs was the best LP of the eight that I made to date.
You made eight LPs?
Eight altogether.
That's terrific.
You know, I made A Wild Bee's Nest, The Irish Edge, The Mountain Streams, The Flowery Vale, Dobbin's Flowery Vale is, but we called it the Flowery Vale, Ireland Her Own, The Lark in the Morning, The Stone Fiddle, which was the last one made by Green Linnet back in 1980, the year that I did the lecture tour after publishing The Stone Fiddle, and there's one other, Lochearn Show. I had tracks on other ones, you know, but those were the ones that were made, and actually they're going to be made into CDs, the stuff that Topic had, all those, according to David Ross, who is the publicity man for my publishers, Appletree. Whoever ACE are, they are making it into
the best of them are being made into a, these hard discs or whatever, the DCs
CDs.
Yeah.
But that's terrific, Paddy. Do you have good sales of those records worldwide now?
Particularly in America.
Yes.
Particularly in America. Of course, you'd be a long time making a fortune on 5 and 10%.
I know.
You know, but still, it's good fun. And
on top of that, it's a sort of immortality.
Well, I suppose
it's a sort of immortality.
You're making a headstone for yourself.
Well, all these stories and poems, lovely books here. Ulster Folk Stories for Children. Now, this is the one that you dedicated to Miss McGrath.
To my teacher, that's
your
right.
Your teacher.
Yeah.
These are all stories that were traditional
stories. Some of them are old traditional stories. Some of them are just figments of my imagination. And some of them are where I'd get the nucleus or the bones of a story and I'd put flesh on it.
Right.
That way. And
when was that published first?
That was published in July 1990.
So it's fairly recent.
Shortly after I had my triple bypass.
You had a triple bypass.
On the 16th of May 1990, after I published Duhus.
Yeah, which is a lovely book, yeah.
8 days after. And
Did you have a bang and suddenly you didn't?
Well, my doctor sent me in here to be investigated, and he discovered that I had an angina and malfunctioning thyroid and things like that, and that I'd have to watch myself. And then I got an acute attack of an angina. I went into hospital, and they fixed me up in coronary care, and they sent me on to Beaumont for an angiogram. So they decided that the triple bypass was the only remedy, and I waited. I got another attack. I had been discharged here, got another attack. I came in that time, and I decided that I wouldn't be let out until I'd go and have the operation done. So it had to be the Black Rock Clinic, because the private part of the matter was booked up for months. So it was done there by very good little surgeon, Freddie Wood. In fact, I presented him with a copy of Duhus.
Did you,
Because he made a great job of me.
Well, he did, because you had the picture of health sitting there, Paddy.
He told me the fact that I was a non-smoker was very much in my favour, But I got over it all right.
Oh, you certainly did. You had the picture of health. Yeah. We better go for record five, because time's marching on as usual.
Indeed. Yeah, always. There's never enough time.
No. Right, what do you go for number five?
Now, this is Noel Hill, the great concertina player. The record is called The Irish Concertina. He's a magnificent player. He's from some part of Clare. I think it's Lissy Casey or Labishida, some of those kind of places. And he got married last week, but that's not the reason that I selected him as my fifth choice. He plays here, among other things, the wind that shakes the barley like no one else that ever played an instrument.
Terrific playing, Paddy.
He's a genius. There's no doubt.
Noel Hill. The wind that shakes the barley. You met in your time, Paddy, in your various tours, because you did a lot of touring, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I was twice in the States. I was over for the bicentennial celebrations. What a mighty time! I write about it in that book there, where songs do thunder. Some of the incidents that we had when we're on that it was Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. that actually funded the thing.
You met Paul Robeson, did you?
I met Paul Robeson, but that was in London.
That was in London.
That was earlier. That was about 58. We were overdoing myself and my brother Joe, who's dead now, I wish him rest, an accordionist and a great step dancer. We were overdoing a big folk
concert in the Royal Festival Hall. And we stayed for a week, and Peter Kendi had us in doing some recordings, and Paul Robeson was there rehearsing a BBC show, and he was going to the toilet, and Peter Kendi said, "Paddy, would you like to meet him?" I says, "Fair enough, but wait till he's coming back." So when he was coming back, Peter went out and said, "Excuse me, Paul," he knew him, first names, "here's a man who'd like to meet you," and very, oh, a very civilized man. And I said, Peter says, he'd like a song. And he said, "What will it be?" And I said, "Old Man River." Mighty stuff. And he says, "You'll have to sing now." He's a big man, you know. Mm. And the wee man then, from Ulster here, or the Northwest, sang. The only thing that he could sing after Old Man River was "The Mountain Streams Where the Moorcocks Crow." Mm. He just took hands with me. Said nothing.
Mm.
And that was a big moment.
It was, yeah. Was one artist recognising another.
Well,
I'm sure that was the case.
I suppose you could say that. Yeah. But the fact that I always admired his singing, particularly the Old Man River, when he went away down to the
Showboat.
Yeah.
He had great resonance.
Oh, he had.
Voice,
no doubt about
he
it.
He was a barrister and everything.
And he was very much... he was very civil rights and sore about the way the blacks were being treated.
Sure, look what's happening today.
Yeah, just look at Los Angeles and all that business.
Right, Paddy, you're on this island. Would you be any good on this island now with your pieces?
I think I would be terrific. I would get... I wouldn't ask for any with these beautiful copper-coloured South Sea Islanders with the grass slopes, you know. But I would like some of the grass to make a hut for myself, you know. And I would think that if I could get some kind of bait that it could keep myself going on fish, particularly as fish is nearly my staple diet now, I think I would survive very well. And, Lord, sure, you could write great stuff there.
You could, but you might never get off to have it published.
You could put it in a bottle and someone would get it, you know.
So your own company you'd be happy enough with?
Well, I think I would. Mm. You know, I suppose eventually one... I remember a man who started talking to himself and someone said to him, "Do you know, Jack, that you're talking to yourself?" Well, I says, "See, I'm fed up talking to idiots. I like talking to a sensible man and not him." Yeah.
Now, two books, Paddy. We'll give you the Bible, that nice Irish version. And
well,
the
I would get that one. the Irish version, the leather-bound one that Kenny's did specially for me and didn't charge me too much extra.
Right.
I would have it anyway.
Right.
Like, that was...
You would.
You'd have it the same. You should have a pair of rosary beads or scapular medal or something like
that's,
that.
That's it.
The Bible. For the two selections of good writing, I would have unquestionably number one, Ma Vale Hain by Seosamh Mac Greana, the great Ranafast writer. In my opinion, the greatest literary work in Europe in the 20th century.
Translated, my what?
My Own Road or My Own Way. It's
right.
It's an autobiography, but this marvellous writing altogether. And it infuriates me when I hear about feebly in a fast 20 years ago and being translated and sold all over Europe and Peg. Very simple, ordinary stuff. And a great classical writer like this, when he died, hardly anyone knew about him. In fact, he came into Coronary Care when I was coming out. And even though he was deaf, when I shouted at him, he knew what I was saying, and we had a kind of a broken conversation. But that would be my first choice. The next one would be Gargantua and Pantagruel by Rabelais, which is a book that would make you laugh if you're ready to drop into the grave. There's no doubt at all about it. Even though I have to read it in the Berle because I have no French. But I suppose any translation loses a bit, but it's terrific even translated into English.
And one luxury, Paddy?
One luxury would be the poems of William Wordsworth.
That's another book now. I suppose, why not?
That
why
would
not?
Be my
that would be a luxury,
because
the poems of Wordsworth.
I would have that before the copper-coloured maiden or anything else, you know.
Paddy, continued success to Paddy Tunney in the years ahead, and the family, Paddy.
Thank you very much
indeed for being my castaway. And we're going to finish off with your sixth choice.
Yeah, my sixth choice is Joe Heaney singing Eleanor Naroon.
Now, this is a typical Connemara singer, not the sweetest, but the most entire singer of them all, of all the Connemara singers. And I mean entire in his full sense, as a Lagan farmer would talk about a stud.
Mm.
You know, he has that great manliness and masculinity in his voice.
Paddy, Tunny, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Billy.
Marish just more.